Hi, I'm Rita Honan, and I grew up initially in South Boston, Massachusetts, in the projects, what's known here as the Flats, and then moved to a lower middle class area we thought was quite lofty at the time, a two-family house. And I stayed there until I finished university and got married and had a baby and had arthritis, so I hopped on to Florida and lived there for 20 years. And I've been in Dublin now for 17 years.
So, Rita, you've chosen two people and one event that have influenced you in your life. Let's start with the first person, please.
Okay, the first person would be Stevie Sullivan. I just had my 64th birthday last Saturday, and Stevie would have had his 64th birthday on Sunday. And we lived in Old Harbor Village in South Boston, and we were on the ground floor, and the Sullivans were just above us. And so when we were born, our mothers shared a hospital room. And, of course, in those days, you stayed there for 10 days. And then Stevie and I became best friends. And we were very best friends until I went to kindergarten and wondered, where's Stevie? Well, it turns out Stevie had a moderate intellectual disability. And that obviously has had a profound effect on my whole entire life, because I am so comfortable with people with disabilities. And that's all I ever thought I would do in terms of a career.
And in regards to, okay, he wasn't there in kindergarten, and you were wondering, where is he? But aside from the schooling, did you continue to play together?
We did, until I moved. I moved at the age of 7. And then, of course, I didn't see him ever. And in the last 20 years, I have tried so hard to find Stevie Sullivan because of the influence he had on my life. I have Facebooked, I have all over the internet. In fact, the last time I was in Boston during the summer, I actually went into the projects and knocked on the doors of both my apartment and his and asked. Of course, that was, you know, many, many years ago, that was 55 years ago, if anyone knew of what happened to the Sullivan or anybody in the Sullivan family. And boy, I would love to get in touch with Stevie Sullivan. Maybe we should have this broadcasted in Boston and someone would come forward. But I often think he probably, you know, went into residential care at some point, you know, into a group home or whatever. But no, I don't know what's happened to him, but I have thought of him. You can't imagine how many times in my life, and I've thought of him and I've thanked him and wanted to share with him and his family the most significant impact they've had on my life, and hopefully in return I've passed that along, or however they say it, pass it on, that I've passed it on.
Describe Stevie for those majority of people who've never even heard of his name.
Stevie, I have a very strong visual image of Stevie. He had thick glasses that were always dirty and kind of cockeyed on his nose. And he had light brown curly hair, lots of hair. I think he probably didn't like getting it cut very often, be my hunch. And very pleasant, always a bit of a smile on his face, and kind of short and a bit stocky. But I have this image of us sitting, again, this was a project, so it was mostly concrete, but there was a little bit of dirt there, I suppose. And my memory is of us, he and I, sitting in that dirt and just playing with the dirt. And as much as I talk today, I don't think we said a whole heck of a lot, but we were just together and we were so comfortable, I suppose, from the day we were born, that we were just best buddies.
And maybe some people might be surprised with that relationship because, you know, you're a very intelligent woman, so you are, you know, as the adult that you've become. And presumably you were quite a smart little girl, even at that early stage, and still there's Stevie. Now, as you're saying, there isn't much, you know, vocal going on between you, but there's some sort of a connection. Can you describe that connection?
Comfort. Just ease. I think we both liked doing the same things. And I wasn't a traditional little girl by any means. I was down in the dirt, and so was he. And I don't know. I think we challenged each other, actually, in some ways. You know, now that I look back on it, that I probably challenged him to engage more, and he probably challenged me to be a bit more relaxed, because I was always hyperactive.
And was Stevie hyper?
Not at all.
So here you are. It sounds like you're poles apart on so many levels, and still and all, there is such a connection. I'm coming back to that word connection again. Do you think maybe even the parents, your own parents, did they recognise the differences, but also that extreme bond that existed between both of you?
I don't know. This is just you bringing it up. It's the first time I actually would have put the term differences between us. My experience is he was just my best friend. I just don't have that memory anywhere, a recollection or anybody. Of course, in those days, nobody said anything anyway. You know, there were all sorts in the projects and everybody got along with everybody, and that's just the way it was.
Did you know he was different? You know, as you say, coming up to the age of 7, of course, you moved then, but up, you know, between the age of, say, 4 and 7, did you have a sense of him being a little different?
No, I don't think I did. I don't think I did. If I did, I think I was just so accepting of him. I know I was distressed when I went to kindergarten and he didn't come. I remember my mother must have hired a girl from the neighborhood to walk, you know, to walk me to school. And I know I was distressed that he wasn't coming. But I suppose I wouldn't have seen any reason why he couldn't come.
Did you have sisters and brothers?
I have 3 brothers and 1 sister.
Where were you in all those?
I was the second last. I was the youngest girl, the fourth child out of 5.
So it wasn't as though you were a child on your own looking for somebody. There was plenty of activity going on at home, but still in all, Stevie, for some reason, there was a massive bond.
Well, yes. Well, he lived right upstairs. I had other friends, of course. You know, one girl, I remember her father had 1 arm. He had been in World War II, and I often wonder what happened to her, too. She was a good friend at the time. But, again, I was quite young. You know, I left there at the age of 7, the projects. But I think he was just always there. We were always there. And our mothers were friends. And, you know, in those days, they put, like they did in Dublin, I suppose, they put the babies and the buggies right outside the door, and the mothers were in the house doing their housework or whatever. And then as you got a little bit older, they just kind of tied you to the bench and left you out there. And so we were at the same age, so we were together.
For people who haven't been to Boston, and you talked about the projects, or a.k.a. the flats, yes, just describe them.
Red brick. And to this day, I have a fondness for red brick. I go down the road toward the Crumlin Road there towards the hospital, and I see those 2-story brick apartments attached to one another. And I think they're for the elderly. I think I wouldn't mind ending up in one of those. I think as bizarre as it probably was, and all the alcoholism and the screaming and yelling that went on in those places, you know, and the adolescents doing damage and all, I still have a warm feeling and memory of those times, you know.
Was it quite a deprived area?
Oh, absolutely, and it still is. Oh, sure it is. It was public, obviously public housing. I remember we had to move because my father started making more than $17 a week, and so we were kind of kicked out. Yes.
So Stevie is somewhere out there, and you have no idea where he is.
No, and I absolutely would just love to find him. Wouldn't that be cool? I mean, and for his family to know just what a contribution he's made, you know, to my life. And then, you know, he's, you know, been a driving force, I suppose you could say, you know, and my whole career has been in disability services and providing, you know, trying to improve the quality of life of people with disabilities.
And you've got very special qualities when it comes to working with people with disabilities, because I've seen that myself. In some ways, can you just relate Stevie and the qualities that in some ways have seeped into your being, mm-hmm, and that now that you can actually be in that very present place with people who sometimes find it very hard to communicate?
I always say it's very natural for me. And, you know, I teach at Trinity College, and I've been course director of postgraduate courses there, but I always come back to this, and I've left my paying job there, and I still just, you know, teach now and again, because Oprah Winfrey, I never watched her program, but I did watch the last one, and she stood on the stage, and she said she knew when she went out there that that was where she was supposed to be. And when I'm in doing a home visit or a school visit or a group home or even in my office here and people come in, I know this is where I'm supposed to be. It's just natural for me. It's not a big deal. You know, it's not that I'm doing anything, you know, super special or anything challenging. It's easy for me.
So it's easy for you. It's not a challenge for you. And it fits like a glove. And if I was to have maybe somebody who you've worked with sitting on a chair just here in front of you, and we told you to shut up and not say a word, right? And if they were to describe to you, well, what is it about Rita that in some ways is nice in terms of being able to kind of have a chat or whatever. What would they say?
I'll tell you about Roy. Roy is a friend of mine, and now that you mention it, he probably looks a lot like Stevie Sullivan does now. And he is locked up in Newcastle Hospital in County Wicklow, and I've been trying to get him out of there for years. He has a moderate intellectual disability, and the teeth are falling out of his head and all that, and he's got a bit of challenging behavior and all. But Roy and I have become very good buddies. His brother owned the pub that I used to go to on a Saturday night in Fort Lauderdale. And I always say I inherited Roy because his parents passed away and he has no relatives or whatever. But if Roy were here, what might he say after having a good laugh? And he'd probably just say, well, she takes me out. I think that's probably what he would say. Yeah.
And they're very simple words, but there's also something else, because maybe other people take him out, or maybe they don't, but even if they do, there's something about that connection between the two of you that makes the going out nice. So what do you think that might be?
Roy and I have our argy-bargies too. I think our relationship is real. It's real. You know, like I get annoyed with him and he can get annoyed right back at me, and we can just be who we are.
And you are who you are.
Well, unfortunately, I'm not very good at moderating or screening my behavior of what I have to say.
Now, that brings us to our second person of influence in your life. So do you want to tell me who that is?
Well, I suppose, and I didn't think of it until just a few minutes ago, that I was anticipating a question that didn't come. But I think it's related to Stevie, and that's my dad. My father was, from a poor family in South Boston. Again, his parents were both immigrants from Ireland. And so he never finished secondary school or anything. And he worked in Sears Roebuck, loading the mattresses on the trucks. My father had a very strong sense of justice. And he could have told you everything there was about Jimmy Larkin, for example, you know. And he ended up being elected by his peers to represent them to Sears Roebuck. And he eventually became the president of the AFL-CIO, New England Joint Board Wholesale Retail Department Stores Union.
Bit of a mouthful.
And so all his life, he had Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola and some of the department stores involved. And so he represented the workers. So he was a union man his whole life. And he fought for the underdog. And he did things like he would take us for trips, road trips, say, to Florida when he was going to a conference or a convention. And we would be driving through Georgia. And where he would take us is the back roads of Georgia, the dirt roads where the African Americans were living in tin roof houses, and he would say, you see these people? It's not their fault they're living like this. And people like us have a responsibility to help them to lead a better life. Now, my father didn't talk to us much, but when he did, these are the kinds of things he said. And you go to New York City, and he was a bit of a kook, I suppose, a bit of an eccentric. And you'd never go up the Empire State Building. He could saw no sense in that, because you can't see it if you're in it. So you'd have to go across to another building, and then you could see the Empire State Building. But where he would take us in New York City, and not, I'd never to this day been to the Statue of Liberty, but I've been down in the back, kind of the bowels of New York City, and seeing the alcoholics and the down and outs. And that's who he would show us. I remember people with the, you know, blowing their nose and not having a tissue. And he'd take us there at 2 or 3 in the morning. We were, you know, school-aged children. But he wanted us to see that side of life and not be afraid of it, I think. He wanted us to see the humanity in everyone. And my sister's a lawyer, and she does all disability law and elderly and handicapped, and, you know, she doesn't make hardly any money, you know. So I think he's had a profound impact on the way that we think and the way that we perceive people and our chosen career paths, really.
And somebody influenced him along the way very strongly, obviously.
I don't know where that came from. His own father was not around. His father was alcoholic. And I think by the time they had the seventh child, invited him to leave, and he never knew his own father. But there was an Uncle Charlie, and I'd say, you know, in this day and age, you'd look back and say, well, the grandmother had a fella, you know, is probably what it was. And I remember him being very close to Charlie, and one of the two times in my life I saw my father cry was when Charlie died. But I'd say Charlie had a very strong influence. I don't know what Charlie did. I don't know what he did. But I remember him as a very calm, caring man, you know, who was very proud of my father.
In all this time, you're talking about being brought to the bowels of New York City at 2 o'clock in the morning as a school child. I'm thinking, sweet divine almighty tonight. What did your mother think of all that?
Oh, she went along with anything. Oh, yeah, she went along with anything. She never complained about that kind of stuff. She probably thought it was interesting as well. I mean, what did she know? You know, she didn't know either.
So in terms of the path that you've chosen, I don't know if your father is still with us.
Oh, no. He died in 1984. Actually, and my mother died 10 years later to the minute on the same day as my father.
But, you know, obviously you were in your chosen path before he passed away. What do you think he thought of where you had ended up?
Again, I don't think it was... I just always was, if that makes sense. I mean... I had my first job in disabilities when I was 15, a summer job, and every summer I worked with the summer Parks and Recreation Department for the City of Boston. And there was no question. At the time, the person who lived upstairs from us was John W. McCormick, and he was Speaker of the House of Representatives. And he was Speaker at the time that actually the President Kennedy was shot. And I remember coming home from school that day, and there were Secret Service men all over our house because he was second in line for the presidency at that point. But Mr. McCormick was a very impressive, just an absolutely regal type person, very quiet, but obviously very powerful. And the only time we ever saw him was in this little front hall. And he didn't have children, so he was very happy to have a little back and forth. And in Boston, if you wanted a job, a summer job, it was political. It was the only way you could get a job. So I recall making a point of seeing him in the hallway and saying, I want a summer job in the playgrounds. Can you help me? And he said, would you work with kids that have mental retardation, which was the term at the time? And I said, well, actually, that would be my preference. So he got me my first paid job in the field, you know?
You started very, very early. I mean, you knew your own mind. I mean, would you say that you are somebody who's always known your own mind, or have you ever sort of doubted your path?
Oh, I suppose I doubt myself and challenge myself as well. I don't think other people see that. I come across as if I know everything, and whatever I'm saying, that I'm totally confident in it. And then I tell my students, but I can change my mind easily, you know, I can be easily convinced otherwise, given the evidence. But it just... what you were just saying there made another trigger for me. You said when, and I think that's with. Can we go to the event, because it's all tied in together. I don't know whether I was 5 or 7, but I was either 5 or 7, and because I was so hyper, my mother was very good. She knew how to manage. She had me taking tap dancing and gymnastics from the age of 3. She had me in acrobatics, you know. And so by the time I was, you know, 6 or 7, I was, you know, fairly good at it. And the dancing school teacher, Shirley Sullivan, her name happened to be Sullivan as well, not related to Stevie, but she used to bring us around to places, you know, when you'd give. And I'll never forget being at the Canton School for Crippled Children, is what they called it at the time. And I know I was very young. And what I recall is children lying on almost like gurneys and kids that were very physically disabled. And here I was doing backflips and barannies and, you know, I had such good use of my body. I remember leaving there saying, when I grow up, I have to do something that will help kids like that. And my first career choice was physical therapy. But at 17, I came down with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. So that was the end of that. Couldn't become a physical therapist. I went to one, but I couldn't become one.
So it was that event, that visit to that particular place that literally had the profound effect on you.
And I didn't realize that until I was actually a doctoral student. And I already had my master's in educational psychology and was working within the field, obviously. And I decided to go back and get my doctorate in counseling. And in one of the groups, they went around and asked people, now these were all mature, all in our 30s at the time. And they went around and asked each individual, at what point and what in your life did you realize you wanted to work with people? And somehow I was at the end of the group, you know, in the circle. And I was quite stunned and maybe a bit shocked that people were talking about things 2 years before or 3 years before. And when they came to me, I was almost breathless. I said, but I always knew. And it stunned me that how come I'm the only, I thought everybody always knew what they were going to do. It was just, there was never a question. No, certainly move around with it. I didn't know exactly what I was going to do. But I knew that generally the types of, I knew I was going to work with people and I was interested in, you know, people with disabilities and that I would do something in the caring professions.
If it came to the point tomorrow morning where you actually couldn't work in the caring profession anymore, couldn't, actually maybe for whatever reason you couldn't, I'm just wondering what that would feel like, because as you say, this is almost in your DNA in terms of that wish and that longing and that yearning and that motivation and that movement towards working in a caring profession and working with people. So what can you even imagine what that would be like?
You just triggered a memory that I haven't had for many, many years.
Sorry about that.
That's okay, but I'm glad I'm not in the U.S. of A, because I'm going to tell you about it. I'm divorced. It's a good relationship with my ex-husband. The first group home I ever worked in as a psychologist, accountant, consulting, counseling psychologist was Woodhouse, and that would have been in 1972. Okay? Now, I'm still friends with them. That's who I have Christmas dinner with every year. We go out to a beautiful restaurant in Fort Lauderdale on the water, and the residents and myself. But they were very important in my life, and it got to the point where in those days, people didn't take folks with wheelchairs and cerebral palsy and intellectual disabilities out and about a lot. And I felt very strongly that they needed to go out and party and go to the Chinese restaurant and all that stuff. So I got my license, you know, to drive the big old van and everything. And myself and my husband at the time used to take them out. And my husband had had a brother in a wheelchair, had muscular dystrophy, that he had passed away. And at one point, he told me that he didn't want me to be spending as much time. I don't know if it was as much time, but he didn't want to be doing those kinds of things. Not that I did it a lot, you know, but it was just now and again. And he said, I don't want to be around so much. And I said, you're asking me to cut off my arms and my legs. How can I give up my relationship with these people? They are such an integral part of my life. So my first reaction was when you said, what would you do if you couldn't? So would I be on board of directors? I'd be an advocate. I'd be out fighting. I've often said that about the residential here. If I ever won the lotto, I'd still stay in Ireland. I probably wouldn't work, but I'd fight like hell for the people in the institutions.
And fight like hell is part and parcel of who Rita Honan is. I mean, I can see it. You know, you fight, you advocate, you know, you want better. Do you ever get tired? I know you said you're a little bit hyper, but aside from that, does the body ever get a wee bit tired?
No, I never get tired, but I do get annoyed with myself sometimes, because just hearing you say that, it actually isn't true. There are people out there that have really dedicated their lives in Ireland to fight for a lot, most of them parents. And these people, you know, whereas I'm in a business as well, and I'm making money, you know. And if you don't have to do that, I think you can do a lot more. But I could choose to do a lot more, and I don't.
Why don't you, if you don't mind me asking?
I suppose, like most people, you get tired, you get discouraged, and you get to a point. I have two grandchildren now in Fort Lauderdale, and I love to spend time with them and them with me. And so it's a matter of prioritizing, and I could do a lot more, and I could have different priorities.
What do you do when you get discouraged? I mean, I'm just wondering what happens to Rita when she gets discouraged. And I'm talking the heart, and I'm talking the head now, quite different. Because I think the head is really strong here, but obviously the heart is huge, and it's pulsating. And so what happens to both of those when Rita gets discouraged?
I go out to eat all by myself, and I read a People magazine, something that's completely brain dead. And then I reflect. And that's counseling psychology trained you to do that. Then I give myself Like if I'm really annoyed with something or there's an injustice, that I initially will maybe, I sit at the laptop and I write things out in maybe a scathing letter or whatever. And then I step back from it. I look at it myself the next day. I have two wonderful colleagues at Trinity College that I run almost everything by and to make sure it's sane and, you know, not libelous, etc. And then, you know, oftentimes I'll follow through and I'll do something. I'll post a letter. Sometimes I've stood, just recently I did that. I had a letter in my hand and I thought, should I post it or not? And I stood in front of the mailbox here on Dame Street and a calm came right over me and I put that letter in the box. I knew it was the right thing to do. You know, it wasn't going to be popular, but I knew it was the right thing to do.
Your dad would be proud.
He would. I hope. He would never say so. He used to say, don't pat yourself on the back, you get round-shouldered.
Rita Honan, it's been an absolute pleasure, and thank you so much indeed for sharing.
Thanks for asking me.